It has almost been 1 week since Barack Obama took the oath of office and became the 44th president of the United States. Since that time, he has signed a number of executive orders, including setting a one-year deadline for closing Guantanamo Prison in his first days in office. Ahead of seeking passage of his economic stimulus plan, President Obama also announced a pay freeze for White House staffers in his administration, stating, "During this period of economic emergencies, families are tightening their belts, and so should Washington." In seeking to break with the previous Bush administration, the new president has also taken the opportunity of his first week in office to freeze last-minute midnight regulations put in by the former Republican president to relax environmental rules. Obama also reversed Bush's first act in office by ending the global gag rule that disallowed U.S. taxpayer money from funding global family planning groups that provide information about abortion. Norman Solomon, nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics, founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and a delegate for Barack Obama, is our next guest. Welcome, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thanks a lot.
So, one aspect of Obama's first week in office that has drawn measured criticism in his Middle Eastern diplomacy, exemplified by the appointment of George Mitchell as an envoy to the region, is taken quite a few people, not by surprise, but almost affirming for many folks who are from the Middle East or who are Middle Eastern watchers, about the silence that we had seen around the carnage that was going on in Gaza. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, neither the carnage nor the silence that you referred to are surprising. And we have a longstanding pattern that has been continued in the last weeks through the news media and on Capitol Hill. I should say that, if my memory serves, one of the five members of the U.S. House of Representatives to vote against a reprehensible resolution a couple weeks back, essentially endorsing the slaughter from the Israeli government of people in Gaza, was Maxine Waters in the Los Angeles area. And I think she certainly deserves commendation for that. But the numbers tell you, some 400 people in the House approving it, only five dissenters, and a couple dozen people abstaining. You know, more broadly, there are these deep questions of continuity versus contrast between the previous administration and the Obama presidency. And for better or worse, one of the clearest reference points, at least realities, I think, is alluded to by the jazz musician and Les McCann in his song called Compared to What. If we compare what we know of the Obama approach to what went on for 8 years under George W. Bush, then I think the improvements are very significant in many areas. If we compare, on the other hand, the Obama approach as it can be discerned and what he's already done with what progressives in this country really are yearning for and working for, then we have huge problems and huge gaps that we need to try to narrow as best we can.
So most recently you wrote about the triangulation and referring to Bill Clinton as during his 8 years in office. Can you talk about that a little bit more and for us to better understand that what the comparisons are?
Yeah, I think there are some parallels in the sense that Bill Clinton came into the White House with a policy that he executed, an approach, which was to, for lack of a better term, triangulate between, on the one hand, the progressive, sometimes called liberal, but left liberal or progressive base of the Democratic Party on the one hand, and the Republican leaders on Capitol Hill on the other hand. And so not totally symmetrically, but in general, President Clinton tended to push off against both. And so on issues like welfare reform, military spending, so-called free trade, his promotion of NAFTA and GATT and what became the World Trade Organization, Bill Clinton was very much willing to have ongoing what might be called sister soldier moments when he went out of his way to distinguish himself from those who were sometimes attacked as liberals or leftists. And as a consequence, for instance, in the first couple of years of the Clinton presidency, we had him fighting tooth and nail, using all of his political capital that he could muster to push through NAFTA. And we've seen the results with the maquiladores, the devastation of farming in Mexico, the export of jobs, the race to the bottom. Well, this is something, this is a program that Clinton was committed to, and he pulled out, as I said, all the stops. And so now we can ask ourselves to what extent the Obama presidency will replicate that sort of triangulation. And on paper, anyway, if you look at the cabinet of the Obama administration, that seems to be, I think, a fair assessment. And we will know more in the months ahead. And here's an example. We will discover whether President Obama is willing to fight for the Employee Free Choice Act that is so important to be able to have unions be formed in the workplace in this country, overcome the barriers that have blocked unionization and have made unionization less rather than more prevalent in this country in the past decade and more. And frankly, I am not too optimistic. It depends on what we do, but the new president has said he will sign this measure if it gets to his desk. But will he pull out all the stops the way that Bill Clinton did for NAFTA? There are really no indications right now that he plans to do that.
So, Norman, just kind of sticking back to that comparison, I think if we go back when Bill Clinton became the president, I mean, he didn't have the kind of overwhelming support that Obama has come into the office. Secondly, Bill Clinton carried a lot of his own political and personal baggage, where he, you know, he negotiated away the political, the power that he had just to cover his tracks. I mean, the whole old Slick Willie idiom comes to mind. And we haven't even, for millions in our communities, we haven't even touched the issue of immigration as to what Bill Clinton did, along with the, with completely or almost kind of gutting the welfare system. So, having said that, how do you see, you know, Obama moving forward? That with the tone that he's setting in his first week, I mean, there are these comparisons being made to FDR, but then on the flip side, there's this sense of like, you know, that engaging in sort of or falling into this trap of appeasement in this in bipartisanship. So, going back to Clinton and then where Obama is and the kind of overwhelming mandate that he got, how would you draw that comparison, and how do you see this current sort of wave of his decisions that he's taken in the first week?
Well, numerically anyway, when Bill Clinton came into office, it was with roughly the same sort of numerical mandate, if you will, that Obama has. Now, granted, the enthusiasm level is much higher for Obama out in the country than, and it was a much more grassroots upsurge for him than for Clinton, but I think a lot of what Obama has going for him is the extreme contrast. The first Bush president was much not nearly as bad as the second Bush president, and a lot of the problems, although as you point out, Clinton had baggage going in, he accumulated a lot more later on in his second term. So it's just to say that there was a tremendous amount of media hype for Bill Clinton, and the JFK analogies were extreme to the point of unctuous, and that footage of him as a teenager reaching out in the Rose Garden to Bill Clinton. I mean, there was just a heck of a lot of this stuff. Okay, well, anyway, that said, I think that obviously because the economy is so much worse now than it's been in generations, Obama has those challenges. He also, we hope anyway, has some personal qualities, much less narcissism than Clinton personally, and so forth. But it has to be said that Obama's entire electoral career, from the time he first ran for the state Senate, or even before that, running for, well, I guess he ran 10 years ago for the state Senate and Congress unsuccessfully in close succession, he's always hitched himself to corporate engines. Obama has always found ways to make very close accommodations with corporate America. And so that is his orientation. I believe that he is centrist in many regards, and yet he has some progressive tendencies. So let's get then to the last part of your question, which is FDR. I think that if we don't have illusions about Obama, then we understand that he is somebody who came out of corporate America. He has yet to make the kind of statements FDR made when Roosevelt challenged what he called the economic royalists. And yet, early on, Roosevelt told the left, literally and figuratively, he said, if you want me to move in your direction, then make me do it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is that real possibility that if we continue to organize effectively, that Obama could become, because we can become, as progressively mobilized as the left was in the 30s, Obama could become as great a progressive president as FDR, not because it's inherent, not because it's inevitable, but because if we organize effectively, we could move the political ground through which he walks. And I believe, and I would sum it up this way, that Obama is good at seeking the center of political gravity. And if we as progressives don't like where that center is, we need to move it in our direction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Norman Solomon, and we're discussing Obama's first week in office. And Norman will stay on until the end of the hour when we take your calls on what you would like to see Obama do in his first 100 days. And the call-in number is 818-985-5735. Again, 818-985-KPFK. Norman, before we go into the listener calls, then the you talked about and referring to FDR's "Make Me Do It" statement. There's also this sense that, given the state of the economy, and maybe drawing those parallels, that FDR didn't have to deal with this massive federal deficit. We're looking at trillions and trillions of dollars, but now that's kind of fallen in Obama's lap. So how do you see him kind of just negotiating this whole terrain that, because on one hand, the economic crisis, just basic social services, basic access to health care, that is kind of going the wayside. We are seeing closures of clinics. We are seeing closures of any sort of vestiges of safety net that is left. In essence, the sense being that the country is bankrupt. And this is a pretty critical scenario that he has on his hand. How do you see that playing out? And then how do you see the barrage of criticism that we can expect from the right wing, I would call hate radio, that we get listened to all the time?
Yeah, well, this is a realm in which the center is moving leftward, both because of groundwork that many progressives have done at the grassroots and also the conditions. There is no debate anymore, really, about the need for large-scale deficit spending, at least in the short to medium term. There's no debate over Keynesian economics or the need to do, one way or another, massive federal spending on the fiscal side to get the economy moving in better shape. We should remember that when FDR first ran for president in 1932, he was what we would now call a deficit hawk. And in a speech in Pittsburgh in 1932, he said that he hoped and would push for the federal government to cut its spending by 25%. If he had fulfilled those promises as president, we never could have had a new deal.
Mm-hmm.
And the environment was changed by conditions and by people organizing effectively at the grassroots. I think now we have, as progressives, to change the terrain to further widen discussion so we can talk about $1 trillion stimulus package, not just as a figure out of the air, but because this is a massive need. We have states and California as much as any with huge deficits. The states can't do deficit spending, so the federal government has got to do that, and we need it in terms of public investment, not the outrageous bailout giveaway, the first half of it, the $350 billion, basically lining the corporate pockets of banks and others so that they can buy each other. And so that needs a shift there. I would just say that this is a tremendous opportunity to alter the way in which we look at government in the mass media and see that it's essential to have government, yes, as Obama said in the closing weeks of the campaign, redistribute the wealth.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, on his issue of continuing to be, I would say, hawkish on the military front, and for someone who's an immigrant and migrating from Pakistan, unfortunately, the first present we got from our new President Obama was the missile strikes that took place a day after coming into office. So, Norman, if you wouldn't mind staying on with us, we're going to be going to listener's call. But before we do that, we have a message from our subversive historian.
Hi, I'm Christine Blosdell, senior producer here at KPFK. Happy New Year to all. We're starting the new year with some changes around KPFK. We've already got our wonderful new general manager, Sean Heitkemper, and by now you must have heard that we've brought in some fresh voices, including a domestic goddess. But what won't change is our commitment to serving our listener sponsors the most progressive, hard-hitting news and public affairs, a commitment to the coverage of stories that other media outlets just won't touch. Yes, you can expect the same determination to get to the truth of the most important matters. And all of this is made possible by your generous support. It's Fund Drive time, and we invite you to continue to support your favorite radio station with donations and as volunteers. We begin the drive on February 6th and continue through the following weeks. To volunteer, contact Tony at 818-985-2711, extension 513, or visit kpfk.org and click on Volunteer. Once again, that information is 818-985-2711, extension 513, or go to kpfk.org and click on Volunteer.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Exactly 70 years ago on this day in people's history, the leftist libertarian youth paper Ruta, or The Path, ended its publication within Spain. On January 26, 1939, the city of Barcelona fell to the nationalist forces of General Franco. With fascists in control, an outspoken radical paper such as Ruta could no longer function in Spain as a consistently issued weekly. Prior to its demise, Ruta had been an independent outlet for the left in Spain during the Civil War. Ruta resurrected itself in France, where it became an opposition voice in exile to the tyranny of the Franco dictatorship by publishing exclusive on-the-ground reports from Spain. In time, Ruta would once again be on the move after Gaullist France repressed anti-Franco publications. The paper's new home would be found in Venezuela, where it published once more on the anniversary of Spanish Escuela Moderna founder Francisco Ferrer's execution. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
Welcome back to Uprising. This is your guest host, Hamid Khan, sitting in for Sonali Kulhatkar. And once again, our call-in number is 818-985-5735. We want to know from you as to what do you think President Obama should do in his first 100 days in office. And we have a bunch of list callers, so please keep your questions short, and we're going to bring Norman on the line to make a response to that. And our first caller is Carlos from Carson. Carlos, are you on the air?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Please go ahead.
Great program. Listen, I would like to see Obama actually force the banks, what they got the money from the bailout, to actually relax the standards so they can start lending the money out. The banks have held on to the bank to prop up their depleted reserves. They're not lending it out. We need this lending out facilitated so that we can get the business cycle going. We're essentially doing the same thing as in the 1929 Depression. Mm-hmm. When people needed to borrow money, the Federal Reserve restricted lending, and then the Depression was prolonged. The same thing happened in the 1800s to various depressions that we had. When people needed to borrow money, the banks were not lending it out. We got to do the opposite of that. And also, he needs to impose an oversight of how the money is used. There is no oversight whatsoever how the bailout money is being used.
Right. Thank you, Carlos. Norman, any comment on that?
Yes. One of the most pernicious aspects in early fall when the bailout of Wall Street was pushed through Congress was this drumbeat coming from mass media and from forces in Washington and, of course, Wall Street, saying that the credit of the country was frozen and this bailout package would unfreeze it. And, of course, it hasn't unfreezed it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the media, I mean, the members of Congress who first voted on a Monday against the bailout package, and people may recall it first failed in the House, they were berated and denounced, for instance, and we could have hundreds of examples. New York Times columnist David Brooks said that this was absolutely irresponsible, that the expertise of the Fed and these so-called wise economists needed to be deferred to. And it wasn't a week later before he said that a lot of this was just political theater and nobody knew how to fix the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, this measure was jammed through, and we've seen the results, which is what the caller alluded to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next, we'll go to Nicole calling from Pomona. And once again, we'd appreciate it if you could keep your comments and questions short.
Hi, my call, I agree with caller number one. I'm a single mom and own a house and was lucky enough to buy a few years ago, but now I need to refi and get my loan lower with this 4% rate, and nobody will touch, as well as a few of my girlfriends, any of us, yet, you know, it's amazing to me that they have this money and the bank won't allow any of us, you know, we're in this position of this catch 22 and we fall in this gap that we don't make enough so nobody will refi us to be able to continue. So we're going to lose our houses. I don't understand that.
Right, right. And Nicole, thank you for calling in because, you know, that reflects the predicament of millions of other people in our communities. And unfortunately, so maybe, Norman, if you can comment on that, that, you know, on one hand, we see this billions and billions of dollars, the TARP program, the bailout, so-called, that's going into the banks. But yet at the same time, are they covering the losses? It's like robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, we, the federal government, through the taxpayers, have been subsidizing a lot of bank mergers and acquisitions. And this was clear pretty early on in the fall when the New York Times reported, for instance, a conference call where a top banking official said, hey, this money's coming in. We're not going to use it for loans. We're going to use it so we can acquire other banks. This was not rocket science. This was ideologically driven and stampeded through the news media, the corporate press, while, for instance, independent economists like James K. Galbraith at the University of Texas, Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean Baker, for instance, was saying he couldn't see a single reason why the bailout program for $700 billion, as drawn up by Paulson and mildly modified by Congress, he couldn't see a single reason why it should be passed.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, he and the callers have it just right. This money's been squandered so far, and we need political pressure to make sure that the second half of the $700 billion is spent differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Next, we have Mohammed from East L.A. Mohammed, are you still on?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. If you can speak up a little bit, please.
Okay. Can you go?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Assalamu alaikum. Bismillah ar-Rahim.
Wa alaikum.
The thing about it is that I like to say the following to our President Barack Obama, but before that, I like to remind people that the European, the Israeli Zionists in Israel are from Europe. They're not indigenous to Palestine, so they have no right to be there. Said that, as I said that, I would like to ask President Obama if he can promote any divestiture from any Israeli corporations, products, or banking business. This way we can choke the Israelis and they can go back to Europe by any means or all means necessary.
Thank you. So, Norman, that obviously is something that the caller is talking about, reminiscent of the movement that took place to bring down the apartheid regime in South Africa, all the disinvestment. But the question would be that does the new president, does President Barack Hussein Obama have the courage to stand up to a very, very strong Israeli lobby? He is, of all indications have been before his election and during his election, that he is not willing to take that on.
Well, first let me say that I think rather than talking about people going home to Europe, it's much more fruitful to talk about people having the right of return, including Palestinians who've been driven out of their homes in the West Bank over a period of decades, and that was stepped up in 1967 and 68. Does Barack Obama have that sort of willingness to challenge the long support of the U.S. government for Israel, even when Israel is slaughtering people in occupied territories. I don't see any indication of that. But what we don't know is whether Obama will at least steer U.S. policy away from this just knee-jerk automatic support of whatever the Israeli government does while several billion dollars a year goes into the Israeli government for military purposes. And that shouldn't just be a speculation or spectator activity on our part. We, again, need to change the discourse in the media and in our society so that the guideposts and the media terrain are not tilted in the way that they are. Frankly, what we need most of all is an affirmation of human rights, not in the abstraction only, but in practice. The life of a Palestinian child being just as precious as the life of an Israeli child. Till we can get there in terms of policy and media, we're going to have the same horrific situation.
Okay. We just have time for a couple more callers. So next we'll go to Nadia calling in from Long Beach.
Hello?
Please go ahead, and if you can keep your question short.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to comment on what I believe Obama should do. And I think one of the first things he should do is stop his support for Israel, but I really don't see that happening either, because from the beginning during his campaign, his words were to that Israel's identity as a Jewish state and their security is priority. And not once has he mentioned the Palestinian people. But I think instead of even focusing on what Obama should do, we should focus on what we should do. And I think the first is to look at Obama mm-hmm. as a white supremacist, as every other U.S. president has been, mm-hmm. because he has not challenged the fundamentals of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just his ideals of supporting Israel is further proof of his white supremacy. And,
okay.
And the second thing I believe we should do is...
I'm so sorry, Nadia. We're going to have to cut you out there because we're running out of time.
Oh, let me just quickly
sure.
agree with one of those 2 points. We need to concentrate on what we can do to organize, to share information and perspectives. On the other hand, I don't think it's that useful to throw labels around like Obama's a white supremacist. I mean, if the left wants to marginalize itself, that's a great way to go. Let's talk about issues. Let's talk about what policies we want to have implemented.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Norman Solomon, for your time, and thank you for all the callers who've been calling in with some thoughtful points. And hopefully, I think it comes back to that, how are we going to make him do it? How are we going to mobilize? How are we going to come out in the streets and push for the movement?
Thank you. I want to mention I have a piece on commondreams.org this morning talking about Obama and Afghanistan and warning against the horrific specter of escalation of that war.
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. So here's the subversive thought for the day for uprising. This is the famous labor leader Cesar Chavez, who once said that once social change begins, it cannot be reversed. You cannot uneducate the person who has learned to read. You cannot humiliate the person who feels pride. You cannot oppress the people who are not afraid anymore. We've seen the future, and the future is ours. That's Cesar Chavez, and that's Uprising's subversive thought for the day.